Good afternoon. Next case on our oral calendar today is by ITV, Thompson v. Thompson. Please be seated. Counsel, our apologies for starting a few minutes late. We were in the throes of discussion, not about your case. We're looking forward to hearing your oral argument today. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for a rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated, I believe, in a clock on your screen, I believe. If you could, we can only see one counsel now because of the way the technology works is one has to speak before the camera automatically illuminates the speaker. So if I could have both of you just perhaps announce your representation now so we can make sure everyone's ready and on cue. Okay, we see you. And for respondent?
Hey, good morning. This is Jill Frieders. I represent the respondent, Zandra Thompson.
Thank you to both of you. Counsel, if you could, again, just for the audio recording of our proceedings, go ahead and state your name again as you commence each leg of your argument. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed. Thank you, Mr. Baker. I'm just curious, is there a microphone that you're using or not? Your voice is very faint.
There's a little high here.
If you could bring that up a little higher, perhaps put it on the podium, and that might help a bit. Your voice is faint.
Better?
I think so. Give it a try.
So, counsel, I want to just try to advance my questions and just for a minute assume that we find that the district court's decision to average income over several years was within its discretion, given its findings about the husband's income fluctuation. So just assume that for a moment. Would you help me on it to understand not just what the error was, because I think I track that, because certain years were selected for this averaging and others were not. But how exactly did that prejudice your client? And to what extent?
Well, our
average. My client's receipts for 2018 were right around $96,000. And when you deduct his ordinary and necessary business expenses, you get down closer to $70,000 of income for special maintenance purposes. But if you average the years that the judge chose, his income is significantly more than that.
Well, it does. I mean, I definitely understand the connection between the income determination and the determination of spousal maintenance as well as child support. It doesn't escape me. You all have laid this out very well in your briefs. What I'm trying to understand is, you know, we do have a relatively small number of years that the parties seem to be arguing about. As I said, you've got to carry with me for a moment the assumption that it was okay within the district court's discretion to average the husband's income. What are we getting there for?
Feedback through.
Yeah, we're getting a little. Maybe we can turn the overall volume down a little bit if you can control that.
And maybe that's it. Sorry, counsel. We were having some background noise here. I'm not sure if you hear it or not. So just for a moment, assume that it was within the district court's discretion to average income over several years. This judge did not average income for, didn't include a couple of years, 2017 and 2014, I think. And then we have this other issue about not subtracting expenses from 2018. But what I'm trying to understand is, was this a de minimis error on the part of the district court judge that Mr. Thompson's income would have been close to the same amount, even if 2017 had been included? Or is it a situation where, no, it was prejudicial?
I believe it was prejudicial, Your Honor. I believe that the years that the district court judge chose to use and that he failed to deduct the ordinary necessary business expenses from 2018 receipts resulted in a significantly higher gross monthly income amount. And that if you use the appropriate measure of determining my client's income, the money available to pay spousal maintenance would be significantly less.
Well, let me take a specific example and talk about 2018 for a moment. So you're right. I mean, the district court, and I think respondent agrees with you, that the district court relied on gross receipts for the figure it used when it averaged and relied on 2018. The analysis our respondent provides in her brief, at least the way I read it, is that the judge did subtract out expenses because the judge did not have access to the tax returns and the claimed expenses in those tax returns for that period of time. And if we look at what the judge did to the 2015 and 2016 numbers, the judge appeared to credit what Mr. Thompson had claimed as expenses in his tax returns over what was presented during the course of the evidentiary hearing. So, is that within the district court's discretion to do that, you know, to credit the tax return claim of expenses over the evidence that was presented at the trial, the other evidence that was presented during the trial?
Well, yes. The district court does have discretion to adopt to the tax return expenses. I can tell you what the difference is between the tax return Schedule C's and the Colquist report, which was an expert who was appointed by the court to help value the business. And the difference was that the Colquist report included a straight-line depreciation deduction, as well as a deduction for a personal office assistant. And I believe, Your Honors, under the Frecking case, when dealing with ordinary and necessary business expenses, not including any depreciation as a necessary ordinary business expense is an error as a matter of law. And so I would argue that if the district court found the Colquist report reliable in valuing the business, but gives no reason why it isn't reliable in determining the client's income, which was a main component of business valuation, that to me is an abuse of discretion. And that needs to be clarified by the district court judge. So, the other issue with the averaging and why I think the court erred is when averaging income, caused his income to spike in 2016. As the court is aware, my client purchased a book of business in the very tail end of 2015, and then was able to bring in new clients and write new insurance policies for them, which essentially paid a double commission. So he had a significant spike in his income.
And again, counsel, when you say spike in his income, you're saying 2015 was an increase, 2016 was an increase, and then we have a decrease in 2017, right?
And 2018.
And 2018.
Significant decrease in 2017 and 2018. So if you just look at 2016, 17, and 18, his income has gone down significantly since that point. And so when you're looking at a circumstance like that, it's unfair to my client to average the years because it results in an unrealistic calculation of his income. His current income is not what it was in 2016. It won't be unless he can purchase another book of business like he did that year. And right now his circumstances are such that he cannot. And his testimony supported that. The BD case, as the court is aware, suggests that earning capacity, which is what averaging income means, earning capacity is not an appropriate measure of income unless it's impractical to determine income or the obligor's actual income is unjustifiably self-limited. And there's no finding of either of those factors in the court's decree. So our argument, Your Honor, is that current income is sufficient, and the proof was there.
I have a question, counsel. It seemed like the reason 2017 was handled as it was in some ways was because there wasn't a tax return filed.
Yeah, that's my understanding, Your Honor, although there wasn't a tax return filed for 2018 either.
Exactly. That leads me to my question. If the district court had just gone to the last tax return, that would have been 2016, right?
That would have been 2016.
Which is the one that you claim with some justification is an outlier.
But Your Honor, my client
Just a minute. Is that yes? That the last tax return to which the district court could have referred at the time of trial would have been 2016, which is the claimed outlier.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
In response further to that question, Your Honor, I'm sorry that I interrupted you. My client is a commission-based employee, so his receipts are strictly 1099s from the entities that pay him his commissions. And so all of that evidence was submitted. The 1099s were provided for 2017, 1099s weren't available for 2018, but the bank statements were provided. And again, the court appointed Greg Goldman from the Goldquist accounting firm to go through Mr. Thompson's records and present the valuation for the business, which was based on income generated and expenses. That's the basis for the valuation, and he did that. And there's no finding from the court that Mr. Goldman's report and figures were not reliable or credible. In fact, you have to assume they were because he adopted Mr. Goldman's valuation of the business. Very quickly, Your Honor, the other error with regard to my client's expenses are the fact that the judge simply used his gross receipts or his projected gross receipts for 2018 and did not allow any deduction for necessary ordinary business expenses. And it would have been impossible to have a tax return filed in 2018 because the trial was mid-year. And so if you look at Mr. Goldman's report, the Goldquist report, my client's necessary and ordinary business expenses have been very consistent, going certainly all the way back to 2014. Those are all outlined in Mr. Goldman's report. And I already explained the difference between the figures in Mr. Goldman's report and the tax returns. But certainly, it's an error as a matter of law not to give my client credit for any necessary and ordinary business expenses. And there was testimony and bank statements in the Goldquist report to support those expenses. On the property division side, Your Honors, my client is in a position where he's required to sell are his house, his truck, four-wheeler, and his business. As a minor child who lives with him half-time, selling his house is not practical. In addition, it isn't going to generate the kind of equity that would pay off the equity balancing payment, and so the only available option to him is to sell his business. On our motion to amend findings, we argue true value, or there indicates the best way to value an asset is to have a sale of that asset to a third party.
Of course, isn't that sort of always true in these cases? I mean, anytime you're dealing with small business in a dissolution situation, I suppose in the best way to figure out how much it's worth would be to find a willing buyer. I mean, isn't that always true?
Yes.
So
yes.
You wouldn't say that we should say in a published opinion that whenever there's an asset in this situation, the district court has to order it sold, would you?
Not if there's another way to come up with the equalization payment, but when you make an order forcing the sale, then I would argue that the sale price ought to be the value. Otherwise, somebody's going to get a windfall potential here.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument. You are out of time, but you will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use it. I think while respondents getting prepared, I think it's the microphone level in our courtroom that seems to be loud. I don't know. Do you control that?
No, I can.
No, we can figure it out. Maybe it's just.
It was. Mine.
Just turn this down.
Okay. Yeah, I think yours is really loud. Is that testing? All right, we'll work it through. All right, counsel for respondent.
I would like to first address the issue of calculation of income and why there's a difference between the tax returns and the Colquist report. The Colquist report, which is Exhibit 38, was prepared to value the business. It was a neutral business appraisal. The terms of the report say, quote, at the court's request, Colquist, Seitz, and Goldman was retained to prepare a calculated value and calculation report of the above business to assist in the dissolution. And their whole report is to determine what is the value of the business. Exhibit 38, page 4, is a spreadsheet prepared by Mr. Goldman, and it is the indicated value of equipment and intangibles. And he's done that to help figure out what is the value of the business. And he has taken information from the party's tax returns and made adjustments on this form to help calculate the value. And it's specifically called an adjusted historical Schedule C. And some of the differences between the Schedule C and this form include amortization of the client base. Opposing counsel referred to that as a depreciation adjustment. I don't know that it is an appreciation adjustment. And if you look at the party's tax returns, which is Exhibit 18, if you look at Schedule C for 2015 and 2016, there's either no depreciation expense or minimal. If you look
at the copy I've got here is not the greatest copy, but that's line 12 under part 2 of Schedule C, and it looks like there's nothing on that line.
Correct. And on 2016, there was $12 of depreciation expense. So there was no depreciation allowed by the IRS for this business in 2015 and an insignificant amount in 2016. Another difference is that if you look at office assistant, that amount did not come from the tax returns. That there's a notation per Eric T. And if you look at the tax returns, Schedule C, there is no office assistant expense. There are other things that are not on here. There are expenses that are personal cell phone and the like that are on Mr. Thompson's personal budget that he also tries to claim as a business expense. So I think the court had very good reason for using the tax returns in 2015 and 2016. Another thing that I want to point out on page 4 of Exhibit 38, there's two different profit lines. There's probably like two-thirds of the way down, there's a net profit line, and a little further down, there's a seller's discretionary earnings. And those are very different numbers. Mr. Thompson wants the court to use the smallest calculation on this form. But again, this form was never created to determine what child support is. This form was created to determine the value of the business. And if you look at the very bottom, it applies multiples to the seller's discretionary earnings and then comes up with a value of the business.
Counsel, if I could interrupt you, and you may need to go back to this detail to answer my question, but I think what the appellant's argument is, and I'm getting a little feedback, so I'm just pausing for a second. But the appellant's argument is that you're supplying reasoning from the district court with regard to why certain expenses were not considered by the district court when it determined appellant's income, but we don't have that analysis. Our court doesn't have that analysis in the district court's written findings. So is it appropriate for us to supply them based on the reasons that you're offering during your argument when the district court did provide that reasoning?
I think that it would be appropriate to say that there is a basis within the record to support the trial court judge's decision. I don't think the trial court is required to make findings of every potential possible variation of the facts. This court said it relied on the tax returns, and it relied on the gross receipts for 2018. The court explained why it didn't use 2014. That new book of business had not yet been purchased, and so that would be different. So I think the trial court gave you a good enough findings to.
Well, let me pinpoint it. So we have the district court relying on gross receipts from 2018 in that averaging process to determine determine appellant's income. Well, we all know gross receipts is not the income that appellant had for 2018. Now, you've supplied reasoning for why the district court wasn't satisfied with appellant's offer of proof as to what expenses were in 2018. But that's not the same as this court having the district court's analysis on what actually was appellant's income in 2018.
Okay. Yes, we would much prefer that you affirm, but we could understand you wanting to remand it for further findings. Thompson to avoid a spousal maintenance obligation. His argument is that he can't afford to make the payment, yet the parties invested. Mr. and Mrs. Thompson invested $198,000 into this business, marital assets. And he's suggesting that he should not have to reimburse her in a timely fashion for her share of that. Now, because of other assets she's receiving, that gets down to $40,000. But $40,000 is not an overreachingly large amount of money. He could refinance his house. He could refinance the business. There are ways for him to come up with this money. And to argue that Ms. Thompson should not benefit from the significant marital asset that she helped invest in marital funds throughout the marriage is inequitable.
Well, if he refinances the house or the business, wouldn't it be necessary then to calculate in the costs associated with that refinance and the ongoing obligation to repay for the refinancing and reduction in income?
I don't think there's case law to support that. There most certainly isn't. There are many cases where a party is ordered to pay a property settlement, and that person is either refinances, or if the recipient is the person receiving it, they get interest at the judgment rate. So the cost of financing is anticipated to be on the person making the payments. I'm not aware of any case law that says that that's a joint obligation of the parties.
One of the facts I'm a bit confused about in the record, counsel, and I probably just missed some of those details, has to do with the purchase of this additional book of business in 2015 for, I think it was $198,000. That apparently was financed in some way by the couple, what, a second mortgage on their home or something like that?
I don't know the details of that, and I'm not certain that they're in the record.
Okay.
I do know that it is paid in full.
All right. Well, and that was my, apparently it did get paid in full, and so didn't become part of the, I mean, sometimes that would be part of the analysis of the value of this business, but it wasn't because the couple had paid it in full, right?
Yeah. If there was a debt still associated with that, that would have been a marital debt that would have been accounted for. But it was not, because the debt no longer exists. So, it's our position that the maintenance is appropriate. The child support is a relatively small amount. In our opinion, we would ask that the court affirm the trial court's decision. And I don't have anything further. If you have further questions of me, I'll be glad to entertain them.
Looks like there are no more questions. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
So if there are discrepancies between tax returns prepared by my client and Greg Goldman, who is a certified public accountant, I would certainly think it reasonable to err on the side of a certified public accountant in what ought to be a reasonable and ordinary deduction for tax purposes. With regard to property division, I want to point out that Mr. Thompson is not suggesting that Ms. Thompson not be reimbursed for her marital interest in his business. He's simply saying that I'm in a position, the court put me in a position where I have no choice but to sell that business to pay her her equalization payment. So rather than putting an arbitrary value on the business in the asset table, let's order me to sell it, and we'll use the sales price as the value dictate the equalization.
Is it accurate to describe the district court's valuation decision as arbitrary?
I think the district court used the report by Mr. Goldman to place a value on the business. But according to the Nardini case, a forced sale of the business at that value from Ms. Thompson Thompson to Mr. Thompson is the least reliable way to value an asset.
Well, let me just follow up on that for a second, counsel, because as I read the testimony that appellant gave during the trial, he had no issues with the Goldman or Colquist report as far as it determined the value of his business. He doesn't quibble with the $125,000 figure. I think he was pretty clear on that.
Fine. And if my client was able to keep his business and continue to run it, we would not have any argument here. But unfortunately, that is the only real asset that is available to him or makes sense to him in this case to sell. And so if the court is making an order forcing him to sell the business, then the sales price ought to be the value, not a paper valuation, which is the least reliable. And my client's concern is, if he's forced to sell his business and he only generates $100,000 from a sale, yet the asset is valued at $125,000 in the asset table, Ms. Thompson is getting a windfall here.
Well, but didn't he in that same snippet of testimony that Judge Bradfield was talking about say that he would use that estimate of value by the expert if he were to sell the business?
He said that he would start the bidding at $125,000. That doesn't mean that it's going to sell for that. Think of real estate sales. You know, you may have a market analysis that says your home is worth $250,000, but it doesn't mean that's what you're going to get for the sale. It could mean that you only can get $225,000 for your house. But if it's valued at $250,000 on an asset table...
But on the record here... Maybe a different way of asking my question is this. On the record here, where else would we look other than the expert's report and the appellant's agreement with it to find that it's wrong? Is there another valuation, or did you find a person who was willing to buy it but not at that price or anything like that?
No, our argument is because the court ordered...
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we do. I'm sorry.
Sorry. My argument is that because the court ordered an equalization payment at the level that it did, my client is forced to sell his business. And the sale of an asset is always the best way to determine what something is worth. And so because the court order forced the sale, that's what we ought to use for value.
Pause you for 1 second. You don't have much time left, but if you could, is there a way, Ms. Frieders, to turn off your microphone and still be able to hear? I wonder if that's where the feedback is coming from, the microphone at your podium.
I don't seem to be able to turn them off. But the squeaking stopped. It was the heater here. The furnace.
Oh. All right. Not feedback at all. All right, Mr. Baker, we'll give you another minute to wrap up. You were interfered with, I think, by the need to keep Ms. Frieders warm.
Well, it's okay. So also in response to the purchase of the previous book, my understanding is that the parties were able to encumber their homestead on some level of the book, but my client actually had to have his parents co-sign on the loan to buy the book. And that option is not available to him at this time. In addition, if you look at the degree, the value of his house, the balance on the mortgage, he's at 80% a debt-to-equity ratio. And he cannot borrow enough money against his home to pay off his equalization payment. So again, the only logical thing that he can do to pay it is sell the business. That ought to determine what the value of the business is, and the court can then equalize the other assets. I don't have anything further, Your Honor, unless you have questions. Thank you.
I think we're squared away. Thank you for your arguments, both in writing and orally today. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We will issue our opinion resolving this matter within the statutory period. The case is submitted. This is our last case on our oral calendar today, so we are in recess.